Accession number 9450, reel 2.
Mr. Watson, reel 2. Now, you were saying that they'd brought these Englishmen in. Could you continue from there, please?
Yes, the people, particularly around Edinburgh, in Edinburgh and around Edinburgh, were so annoyed about this that they felt they were bringing Englishmen in from the south of England and taking over work in Scotland and then sending the Scotchmen into the army, into the forces, which they didn't like at all. And they were so bitter about this that it was quite frequent for women to go down onto the Waverley station and meet the trains that came in from Rosyth on night time to take the men home, and they booed them and created quite a disturbance.
Did you witness it?
Oh, yes. Yes, I've seen them calling the Englishmen and really getting upset about it.
What did they call them?
English swine, English, various names. You can understand their feelings. They felt that their young sons and sweethearts and so forth were being sent into the army, into the trenches, and bringing other people in to do the work. They felt very hurt about that. And that was it.
How did the English workers react?
Well, they acted some of them just ignored it and got off the platform as quickly as possible. And of course, none of them enjoyed it. But nevertheless, that did go on.
Was there any violence?
In any case, the English at that time weren't very popular in Scotland at all, because there was a strong feeling that the Scotchman was being taken advantage of and that English were getting privileges that their men weren't getting. I don't think that was true, but that's what they felt about it.
What specific privileges?
Being able to evade going into the forces, taking over jobs and releasing their men. It really got very upsetting to the Scotch people, that.
Was there any violence at Waverley Station?
No, I didn't see any violence, only annoyance.
Would there be many strikes in your personal experience?
No. There was only one strike that I remember, and that happened after the war. And when the war finished in November, the men felt that naturally there was a tremendous amount of work that had lost through the war effort, and they could quite foresee there was likely to be unemployment. So they tried to get the hours reduced from 54 down. In fact, some parts, Glasgow and various places, were asking for 30 hours a week, some wanted 40, and they did come out on strike, and they were on strike in Edinburgh where I was. It didn't last very long. But they ended up by getting 48 hours, so it went from 54 to 48. And that lasted, for a long time, till just a few years ago, which now I think it's 40.
Which factory was this strike in?
All over the engineering factories, both in Edinburgh, Leith and Glasgow. That's where the concentration of marine engineering was, you see. And it didn't last very long. In Edinburgh, I remember that there were quite a number of chaps. They marched up from Leith up Prince's Street, up to the Waverley Market, and held a meeting there. I think that was in January 1919. And various demonstrations. It never got out of hand. It never got very serious. But they were out of work for a few weeks. I'm not sure how long. And they did. It ended up with everybody having 48 hours a week.
Did you go on strike yourself?
Yes, I came out with them, but I wasn't out very long. I got rather tired of... I didn't have to come outside. Apprentices didn't have to come out with the men. But I did come out. I didn't feel like going in when the men were out. And I went down to Leith Docks. I heard there was a ship in Leith Docks that was under repairs, and I went down and helped them.
Doing what?
repairing the marine engine.
Did any of the people you worked with decline to go on strike?
I'm not sure. I'm really not sure, because as a matter of fact, I didn't go back to that firm again after that. This ship that I helped them to repair the engines, I went to sea with that. So that I didn't get back again to the firm I was with, and Brown Brothers.
Was there a lot of discontent at that time after the war, immediately after the war in 1919?
Well, I don't know if there was a lot of discontent, but there was a lot of fear of men losing their jobs, and certainly a lot of men did lose their jobs, because a lot of the work which had been naval work beforehand was all stopped. So they got back to more or less bread and butter work, and they were carrying large numbers of men that they didn't have in the peacetime, you see, so naturally there was a lot of men lost their jobs, and the only uneasiness was, of course, through fear of losing a job, and which a lot of them did. In fact, up and down the country, the numbers of shipyards that eventually in the early 20s completely closed down, and they've never opened again. And Sunderland, for instance, there was something like 10 shipyards in Sunderland one time. In fact, it was the largest shipbuilding town in Europe. Now I think there's about 2. You can imagine what that's like.
Coming back to the joining of trade unions, in the factories in which you worked, were there men who took some kind of principled stand against not joining trade unions, who said it was against their principles?
No, I didn't meet any of them. There probably were men that didn't like it, but they were just simply compelled to join because they wouldn't have got a job. They had to be in the trade union. But I think the general outlook in that sort of thing was that they realised that for protection's sake, it was better to be a trade union member and have the backing of a trade union behind them. The trade union solved various disputes that could happen. For instance, accidents. A man could have rather a serious accident. He had a great difficulty in getting compensation. Well, the trade union would fight his case if necessary. They had their lawyers would put on the job and did get terms that they were really entitled to. But there were so many firms who would take advantage of that sort of thing. So that without the backing of the trade union, you could lose.
Did you ever personally get the trade union to represent you?
Yes, but it wasn't carried on. I did go down. I had an accident in Coventry here. They'd laid me off for, I forget how many weeks I was off now. And I was advised, in fact I'd word from the AU to go down and see their legal department in London, but I didn't carry on with it any further because I didn't think it warranted it. I didn't think I'd do any good pressing the case any further, so that was allowed to drop. But had it been necessary, this is where the trade union movement would have come in.
When was that?
Oh, when was that? Can you remember when that was? Yes, it was just after the war. I'm not sure of the date.
Just after the Second World War?
After the Second World War, which would be around about 1946.
Wasn't it when we had B-Day or something?
What about women in the marine engineering? Did you ever have women workers?
Yes, oh yes, it was quite common. As the war developed in the First World War, and of course in the Second World War there was plenty, but in the First World War, which is about the first time that women were introduced into marine engineering, it got quite common, that mostly on machine work, drilling and capstan work and mass production machines, quite a number of them. And even in the fitting shops, doing jobs that men used to do at one time, semi-skilled jobs like frazing and polishing metals and that sort of thing.
Why were they put onto those particular jobs and not
others?
Well,
they were jobs that they could do without too much training, you see. They were only what was known as semi-skilled work.
Could they not have been trained?
Well, yes, I suppose so, but you didn't hear of women taking training in engineering. They do more so today, I believe, than they did then.
Why did they not take training then?
Well, inclination, I should think. I don't think there was any other reason. There was a... I believe that a Newcastle firm, I've forgotten who they were now, the director's wife started a women's engineering group, Parkinson's. I think it was Parkinson's. Parsons on the Tyne, turbine people. I think Lady Parsons started a group to encourage women to take up trades like fitters and machine hands in engineering. But there's never been, even right up to today, there hasn't been a preponderance of women engineers. There are a few, but I should say they're very few.
Why do you think that is?
Well, probably just a matter of not liking the work, or whether the work being dirty probably, or heavy, or... They're more inclined to go in for clerical work and that sort of thing, aren't they? Or nursing. No. You don't get many going into engineering, especially heavy engineering.
Would they have been able to do the jobs, do you think?
Oh, yes, I think so. I think it was just a matter of likes, being interested enough to go into it, probably because it was heavy or dirty. There was work, there were women working in the foundries, which was quite a dirty job, core making and that sort of thing. But there were only a few.
Would they have had the muscular power to be able to do it?
Some jobs, not every job. Some of the jobs would have been too heavy and too bad for them. But there were jobs in engineering they could do and did do lighter work.
Which jobs?
Mostly machine work.
Which jobs would they not have had the strength to do?
Well, lifting heavy parts like there is in heavy engineering, particularly in marine engineering, where the parts are all very heavy to handle. I would say that would discourage a lot of them to do and they'd find it rather difficult.
Were some men also incapable of doing that job?
Well, yes, they would. Even some of the men would have found it a bit much. But usually, of course, the men chose jobs, which I suppose the women would as well, jobs that they could do, which are quite a number of jobs. But women mostly went on machine work, where machines were set up, they had men setting these machines up. And they were more or less miners, machine miners, just watching the machine and doing various operations that were shown to do. But a lot of machines were automatic and it didn't call for a great deal of skill. They could be very trying, the long hours and piecework very often, where they'd have to be really working hard to earn money. And they did work very hard, a lot of women.
Would they have
in fact, on piecework, the women were mostly better at it than men. The men would get so fed up doing repetition work, where the women didn't get fed up that way. Every time a woman earned extra money, she could perhaps see a new pair of shoes or a new dress or something for the house or this sort of thing. But the men were entitled to get bored with it. Women didn't get bored as easily as that. It was always an incentive for that the more money they earned on production, the more things they could buy. The men didn't look at it then that way, I don't think.
Would the women work the same hours?
Yes, oh yes. Yes, they worked night shifts, and it was common factory and common in most factories to work fortnight about, a fortnight on days and a fortnight on nights, which they did the same as the men did. Oh yeah. Worked the same number of hours, same conditions.
Would they also join the trade unions?
Quite a number of them did, yes. Because in a trade union shop, they would naturally join. That was the setup. They'd be encouraged to join. But there were shops, like we had in Coventry, there were several shops here, Courtauld in particular. They didn't, you didn't have to be a trade union member to work at Courtauld, and the union couldn't force it either. They were a non-trade union shop. They didn't object to people being the trade union. But they didn't insist on people being in a trade union.
Were women just as inclined to join a trade union as men, or were they more reluctant?
Yeah, I would say there were only few that particularly wanted to go in for it. There were a few women. In fact, some of them became shop stewards in their particular sections. Got very interested in the trade union movement. Oh, yes, you get women interested in trade unions and politics and... Not perhaps as much as men, but there's quite a number that do take an interest in it.
What were the relations like between the men and the women? Did it cause any friction that women should come into?
No, I never saw any trouble at all. No, I wouldn't say there was any friction whatever. And it was an accepted thing, especially during the war, that it was a necessary thing to have extra help. And in fact, the position was that women of certain ages had to do something. They either had to go into factories, join the forces, or go on the land, or do something that was helping the war effort. That was compulsion.
How did people react to that compulsion? Did they resent it or not?
No, just simply accepted it. No resentment that I know of. It was just accepted as probably as a bit of a nuisance. They didn't like doing particular things, but it was acceptable because he had got to simply do it. It was part of the war effort. And if you start objecting, like conscientious objections, either political or religiously, you could be punished for it, and they were punished for it, especially men that opposed to going to the forces or doing something in those lines. They were sent to prison.
Do you remember instances?
And punished very severely, I believe. I didn't know any personal experiences, but I heard of a very cruel treatment being meted out to them in prisons. And they tried to compel them to put uniforms on, and they refused, you know, and things could be made very unpleasant for them.
Was there any provision for women with small children in the factories? Any places for them to leave children?
Well, there may have been in some factories. I didn't come across that. I don't know about that. Not that I knew at all, but I think it mostly relied on either relations, their mothers, or neighbours. Pretty well as much as it is today, I think. Although there's a bit more to today. They have children's schools and things, haven't they, they'll go to. I think in the early part, in the First World War period, it relied on either the mothers or neighbours looking after things for them.
Did the fact that women were in the factories cause any kind of horseplay or hanky-panky or anything of that kind?
Well, you always got that sort of thing. There's always some men ready to take advantage and women to accept the advantage as well, but it was only on a small scale. I don't think it went to any big extent, really. You always get that kind of thing, of course. That can happen in officers as well as engineers, can't it?
Yes. What was the... was there any kind of political feeling during the war which manifested itself?
Well, there was in Scotland. I never saw any of it in England, but in Edinburgh, particularly where I was at Brown's, there were fairly hot trade unions. Shop stewards, some of them were quite warm members. In fact, where I was at Brown's, we had a chappie there on wages were paid out on a Saturday dinner time, and he used to be there selling a paper known as Solidarity. Now, Solidarity in those days was the equivalent of what became the Daily Worker, which today we'd have called a communist paper. I never heard them called communist papers then, but we'd have said that now. Before we heard of communist things, the thing was the Bolsheviks. And if a person wanted to be nasty about somebody, they'd say he was a Bolshevik. Eventually, it got from that to being a communist. I can remember when it was a terrible thing to be called a German. That was an insulting thing to say, a fellow, I'm German. And these are the sort of things that crop up during the war. But in Edinburgh particularly, there were really very hot on various movements verging on the communists. In fact, there's a patch of ground in Edinburgh, and I think it's still there, the mound in Princes Street, where, like Hyde Park Corner, there's free speech. And you could pretty well get in there and say anything you like, providing you didn't cause a disturbance. If you start causing a disturbance, then the police would set in. But just like Hyde Park Corner. And some of the Lanarkshire miners were fairly warm on these sort of things. And I remember one case during the First World War where men like David Kirkwood, who was a marine engine fitter in Glasgow, and he spent most of the war in prison, at Parkhead Prison, because of his opposition to the war. I think mostly a political opposition. They felt that the workers were being taken advantage of. And I remember one man, a Lanarkshire miner, I can't remember his name, but I used to enjoy going onto the mound on a Sunday and listening to these people, and they were quite keen. And he used to get quite naughty as well.
In what way?
Well, this chap, I remember, he's his cap and his red tie, and he would be introduced to the audience, you know, I forget his name now, Brother So-and-so. He'd now have a few words to say to them. And then he would get on the platform and he'd start, "Friends and fellow workers, I remember him saying, you did a fine thing this week." He said, you made Winston Churchill give him the freedom of the city. He said, and the man that ought to have had the freedom of the city, he sent to jail in Parkhead Jail, it's in Aberdeen way. And also at that time, there was great big posters of Kitchener pointing, used to point, and you could see these signs, and as you walked along, looked back, he was still following you with his hand pointing. And the thing was, your king and country need you. Now, I'm saying, you've seen those posters with Kitchener telling you the king and country need you. How much country do you think you'll get? He said, I'll tell you how much country you'll get. 6 foot, that's what you'll get. And you got these fellows who were quite warm. In fact, they started a bit of a movement. The thing that used to annoy them on the mound was just when they were getting wound up with a meeting, you'd get the Salvation Army breaking in, singing hymns and banging the drum, and that used to upset them. So they started parodying on some of their stuff. And I remember the thing that started with a song, "Work and pray, live on hay, for there's pie in the sky when you're dying." And they say, "We want some pie now, not when we die." These are the type of fellas you got. And they were pretty hot round the Clyde and even round Edinburgh way.
Was that a Salvation Army song? Oh.
No, well, they used to have something like that. Work. They didn't sing that, but this was a parody on the Salvation Army thing.
A Salvation Army tune?
Yes, you'd pick a tune and parody on it, you see. I remember another occasion during the First World War where the government got a minister from America, Johnson. He was known as Pussyfoot Johnson. He was a prime mover in drying some of the states up in America, getting people to turn temperance. And they got him over here hoping that they would get the workers to lay off the booze so there'd be more use on the munition effort. And he held meetings in various places, including on the mound in Edinburgh, and he encouraged people to go up and sign the pledge. And if you signed the pledge, you got a badge to pin in your lapel or coat. And on this badge it said, I've dropped my drop to win the war." They also they paid various professional speakers to go around and trying to boost fellas joining the forces. Horatio Bottomley was one of them, man that ran the paper known as John Bull. He used to go around spouting and patriotic speeches, and they got paid for the results they got, apart from their expenses and everything else, and they made quite a profitable business of this, getting various people to go and join the forces. Shame them into the idea of joining the forces.
Did you hear him?
No, I didn't, but I know he did go around all over the country. But talking about Pussyfoot Johnson, the first I remember about that was my grandmother. She came in full of this Johnson and his temperament, what a marvellous man he was, and she signed the pledge.
Did you see him?
No, I didn't see him, no, but she signed the pledge. She showed us this badge she'd got. "I dropped my drop to win the war," and she never drunk in her life. She was a teetotaler from way back. Yes.
How were the anti-war people received when they were on the mound giving these speeches against the war? Were they heckled? Or?
Sometimes, not a great deal. There was more heckling with Johnson, not Pussyfoot Johnson, than there was even with the... No, there was some heckling, but not a lot. People were more or less standing there, either amused or interested in various ways. I was interested in hearing them spouting. I heard them so many times I could almost knew the patter. But it didn't influence me politically or any way. It was just more or less of an interest and more amusement than anything else. But they were really earnest, very earnest. And they believed it was entirely wrong, that it was against work people, the war effort, and the war effort was only useful to people who were making money out of it, which I suppose was a lot of truth in that.
So they weren't frightened to speak against the war in public?
Not at all. No, no. But they did punish people like David Kirkwood and several others where they were causing agitations around the workshops and this sort of thing, and they put them in prison, of course. David Kirkwood was one in particular. There were others as well. He spent most of the time in prison. I remember hearing him say that, I'm not sure, it wasn't even Churchill that invited him out to a dinner and asked him, didn't he think it was about time he could see the light and behave himself. And I think Churchill was right too, because some of these men, these idealists and extremists, they not only punished themselves, but they punished their families, suffered through it as well. And it didn't do them any good, really.
What were your own political opinions at that time in the war?
Well, rather inclined to socialist opinions, mine were. I felt that there was a lot of truth in these chaps that were talking on the mound. In fact, I'm sure they were. But the trouble with some of these things is that if you take it to an extreme, if you can, you know, you get these idealists like Tony Benn and others, and they get a bee in a bonnet, and they're attempting to get something which is unattainable. You can't get anything in perfection, and to get a perfect socialist movement, it isn't on, because the people have got to be perfect before you can get that, and the people are not perfect. So that we have proof of that in Russia, you see, although the Russian movement, there are people, at least they get a living, which at one time they didn't get. The majority of these countries that have gone communist have been through the pressure put on the people. The conditions have been so bad that if somebody's come along and showed them that if they get power, they'll change things and they'll have a job and they'll have some food to eat, of course, naturally they go to that.
So you didn't join a political organisation?
I didn't join any particular organisation, no. But I certainly sympathise with some of the outlooks. But I think that anybody that goes to an extreme in it, it's bad. Whether it's whatever it is, whether it's the Conservative movement or the Labour movement or any other movement.
Were you against the war or for the war?
I don't know that I took any particular... I don't think I really reached any particular opinion about that, but... since then, that was at that time, but since then, I feel myself that the wars are entirely wrong, and in fact I know they are, they're really very wrong. And to think that even you get religious movements today, or so-called religious movements, where they're killing each other like they are in Ireland. You've got Catholics killing Protestants, and Protestants killing Catholics. This sort of thing is wrong, isn't it? And they do this under the cloak of religion, which is ridiculous.
You mentioned this chap who sold this paper, Solidarity. Who was he?
He was a shop steward at Brown's in Edinburgh.
But
I don't remember his name. It's too far back, that.
Did he get any support, or was he just an isolated individual?
No, people gave him a certain amount of support, and he was a very active fellow in the works, and he did keep things in line. One thing that he got, now, they weren't allowed to smoke during working hours, and he forced the issue on the smoking. And it got to a pitch, you know, where the men started losing so much time, you know, going off somewhere in the toilets or somewhere to go and have a smoke while they're losing time on the job. So finally, pressure put on that way, the firm at the finish had to give up and allow, give them permission to smoke.
Because he agitated for it.
Yes, and the very fact that they were losing so much time with so many men hiding out the road to have a smoke.
Was he a young man or an old man?
Well, I'd say middle, somewhere around the 40s, perhaps. But the trade union movement was, and still is, very strong in Scotland. You've just got to listen to these political efforts on the television. Invariably, the active people in this are Scotch. It seems to run in the Scotch. The Welsh have a tendency that way as well, but the Scotch in particular seem to... seem to be leaning that way.
Now, coming back to your own factory work, when you'd get up in the morning, did you dread going to work?
No, I liked the job, I liked the work, you see. And the great attraction to me of going in marine engineering was the idea that ultimately I'd be going to sea as a seagoing engineer. This is the attraction to most people who go in marine engineering.
Why, because of the money?
No, because of the idea of going to sea, going aboard a ship and travelling around.
Now, you said that during the war, the word German was a dirty word, if you said somebody was a German. What did you mean? What did people mean when they said, he's a German?
That was just a slight. If you did something that I didn't like, something that annoyed me, perhaps turn around and say, "I'm a German, that fella." It was just the idea of a German was something that was very, very bad. We were fighting against the Germans were fighting us, and to be a German was about the worst thing you could be. Eventually, that changed to being a communist. Later, years later on, they call you a commie if you start expressing ideas that are a bit different to the ordinary trend. You say, "Well, you're a blooming commie, that fella, he's a communist."
But
it used to be he was a Bolshevist.
But when people use the word German, they weren't referring to people's ideas.
No, it was the thought that Germans were no good. You see, through the war, they caused the war, and there were all sorts of atrocities put down to them, you see. And it's just one of those things. Called a German, it was a bad thing, of course.
Did people hate the Germans during the First World War?
Well, some did, yes, quite a number did. We had an instance in Sunderland, for instance, where there was quite a number of German pork butcher shops. And people were stirred up a lot through the newspapers, talk in the press. We didn't have radio or television then, but they were stirred up with stories in the press about the Germans, because the idea of the press was to try and get people to dislike the Germans to such an extent that people were going smashing the windows in these pork butcher shops and closing them down. And
did you see it?
Oh, yes, we saw it in Sunderland. My wife would see it as well.